Welcome to the Final Draft Podcast. My name's Andrew Popel, and today I'm joined by Charlene Alsop. Now, the Final Draft Podcast is all about books, writing, and literary culture. Every week, Final Draft broadcasts from the studios of 2SER in Sydney. We're broadcast across Australia on the Community Radio Network. And at Final Draft, we are dedicated to exploring Australian writing, from debut authors to the classics that you know and love. Each of these conversations is the way to look at the issues that drive the author's storytelling, a way to help you discover more from the books that you love, because these are the stories that make us who we are. At Final Draft, we record on the lands of the Darug and the Gunungurra people, and I want to acknowledge the traditional owners of those lands and pay my respects to their ongoing connection to their lands, acknowledging they are unceded land and that treaty has never been made with Australia's First Nations. As I mentioned, I am joined on the show by Charlene Alsop with her debut novel. It is called The Great Undoing. This is a tremendous novel. It received accolades before it was even published, winning unpublished manuscript type awards, mentorships. And we are looking at a post-apocalyptic-y spec fiction. I don't know what to tell you about this. It was tremendous to read. And this is a story about story making. It's about exploring history and looking to the future as we meet Scarlet Friday, a truth teller in a hyper-connected world. As their world hurtles toward the future, Scarlet looks into the past to try and understand her place. I really can't wait to share this. Charlene is a tremendous writer, and it's a pleasure to be bringing you The Great Undoing. It's my pleasure to be welcoming to the show today, Charlene Alsop. Charlene is the debut author of The Great Undoing, which through its journey to publication was shortlisted for the 2019 Overland Writing Residency, was highly commended for the 2020 Boundless Indigenous Writers Mentorship. It's tremendous to have her with us today. Welcome, Charlene.
Hello from Meanjin/Brisbane. It's lovely to be here with you, Andrew.
I'm really excited. We acknowledged off air. I'm very excited to chat about this book. This book is so many different things. I hope we get to maybe just peek at a fraction of it. Let's see if I can bring this to the listener. Scarlet Friday is a truth teller in a hyper-connected world. Even as everyone hurtles towards the future, Scarlet delves into the past to understand our place, her place. While Scarlet weaves the threads of her past, discovering her great-grandfather's military service and the hostile reception he received as an Aboriginal man returning to a country that wouldn't recognise his humanity, the rest of the world is teetering on the brink. As systems shut down around the world, Scarlet finds herself on the run. Far from home, she is a refugee seeking safe passage. So much here, all right? We've already talked about how much I want to say and how much we can't say, Charlene. And there is a lot going on here. I think it's best to start by appreciating how you've woven this thoughtful consideration of Australia's colonial history into an engaging and thrilling narrative. I also think it's important to set the scene. So just prior to the novel's titular and cataclysmic Great Undoing, Australia is something of a global superpower off the back of the invention of Blood Talk, a sort of digital biohack that connects the world. I'm personally not sure whether people would truly love or hate this. What was your first thought when you conceived of Blood Talk?
First of all, let me acknowledge that I conceived of Blood Talk before the pandemic. And so my relationship with it before then was incredibly different to my relationship with it after, particularly due to the narrative that was going on in the world about vaccines and that ability or fear or conspiracy theories around the ability to track people. You know, we were living in a very fraught time. So before, when I conceived of Blood Talk, I very much was just looking for a device that would communicate or give imagery around the way that as an Aboriginal person, my blood is my way of navigating the world. It was declared to me, it was legislated that Aboriginal blood controlled a lot of where you could go, what you couldn't do, what you could do in the world. And that was the world my great-grandfather lived in. So it was really a device to try to communicate that idea about blood and our relationship with the world. And so when the pandemic came and all these other conversations were going on, I was really nervous about if I should continue with it and what that might say. But in the end, it just became an adventure too good to turn down.
Blood Talk is kind of this ultimate communication. It connects everyone worldwide. Throughout the novel, though, you also explore the power of language and the power that it has to reveal, the power that it has to obscure, and how language or its destruction is used as a tool of colonialism. So I wondered, in Blood Talk, is that sort of this ultimate colonization of the body?
Yes, the short answer is yes, absolutely it is. You know, our blood has language. Our blood is made of language. And there's, you know, if we were scientists here, we could talk about really fascinating ways of our DNA and about how blood works and how it, you know, is a real source of life to us. But yes, so when it comes to colonization, I think that language is this powerful resistance that we can have. And that was something completely unknown to me before I began examining my great-grandfather's story, this idea that it was a strategy of colonizers to come in to destroy language, to replace it with their own. And one of the most fascinating stories I uncovered, and please, if you're an anthropologist, please give me grace with my language, but I read this incredible story about how language is the best evidence of peaceful civilizations. So Australia had these hundreds and hundreds of language groups on this continent with no fences, and yet it was a peaceful civilization. And the best evidence we have for that is that those languages continued to exist and thrive all together, because when war comes, they come in and they destroy language, and there's less language or one language. So it really fascinated me, this history of colonizers using language to colonize, to control thinking and access. And of course, it still does today. There's incredible work out there on even just accents in language and how that reveals and conceals and controls access.
I mean, I guess we could work to prove that if only we could find a monolingual country with a propensity for war, but I don't know, I'm trying to think of one.
Where would we go? Where would we look at?
If anyone can think of one, please call in. It's not a callback show. It is really startling to look at the world that you've created, and part of the gorgeous storytelling that you create is the way you interweave elements of the narrative and build up as much through suggestion as through directly telling us what this world that Scarlett lives in is. Blood Talk being this sort of biohack, this thing that connects the entire world and colonizing the body, as we've just discussed. And in contrast to that, Scarlett has trained, she works, her job is as a truth teller. She's correcting or perhaps exploding the historical record to provide it with context, to provide it with nuance that's too often missing. There's a particularly powerful scene that I'm going to quote out of context here, because of where it occurs in the narrative, where Scarlett asks, "David, what makes us real? Our story, Scarlett. But what if no one tells our stories? What if there are no records left? Can they live on if they only exist in our memories?" It's incredibly powerful. It's an incredibly powerful question. I wanted to go to this idea of the truth teller, though. What did you imagine for this role of truth teller in the world that you've created, or maybe even in our world?
it was a real wrestle with for me to figure out what a truth teller was and what Scarlett did for a job. What did she go in and do every day as a truth teller? And I need to really say to you that it is still slightly a question, because if we knew the answers to this, surely, surely, surely we would all be trying to do a better job of it. But it all boiled down, as I problem solved, to this question of who gets to be right and who gets to be wrong. And there's never a clear question to that, because we all think we're right and we all think other is wrong. So it boiled down to this idea that a truth teller has one job, and that is to disable monopoly on voice. And that has been how history has been told for as long as we have a record of it, at least a written record of it. And so for Scarlett then to be doing that work of undoing the control of monologue in history, that she is invitational in her approach, that a truth teller invites many voices in and allows a reader to make their own decision about that credibility. Let me tell you, that is still problematic. That is not a perfect solution, but it was the best I could come up with for truth telling, because we have to leave space for our own version of history to be wrong.
This, I think, beggars a moment where we've already acknowledged the extraordinary depth of the storytelling here, that there are elements of this narrative we are not going to go too close to. So I want to bring this next bit in very carefully, in acknowledging that the artifact of the great undoing, that Scarlett's writing of this story occurs in quite a unique way. She has to grasp for any material that she can to record on, and she finds a faded volume, A Short History of Australia, from Ernest Scott. Ernest Scott, of course, is a white historian telling tales about a century ago. And she uses this text to record her own history. Of course, Ernest, he intrudes on the narrative a little bit. And it is an incredible device. I wondered for you, why Ernest Scott, though? What role did you want this intruding imperial voice to play in the narrative?
I wanted Scarlett, first of all, to not be a hypocrite, to allow voices she didn't agree with into her history too. And when I first stumbled across, and it was a stumble, across A Short History of Australia, and I opened it up and it began with, "This short history of Australia begins with a blank space on a map," I just thought, here we have the perfect vessel to allow our reader to decide who the credible narrator is. Because if I was to stand in an audience and show Ernest Scott's book in one hand, a history book, and show Scarlett Friday's story in the other hand, and ask you which one's true, most people would say the history book was true. And I don't think a story actually has to be true to be powerful. And I think that Ernest Scott's history is an excellent example of that. There is so much utter fabrication in this history, this non-fiction book. And yet that fiction was incredibly powerful to create the narrative of nationhood that Australia wanted from their historians. And so I just wanted the reader to be able to see a lived experience, a Scarlett vulnerable truth held up against what an historian claimed our truth to be, and let the reader decide who the credible narrator was.
This is an important point, I think, to unpack a little bit further, because when we talk about voice, we have to also necessarily talk about authority. And very much what you touched on there about the idea of, well, who is telling truth here is who, in the eyes of the receiver, the listener, the viewer, has more authority. And I guess once upon a time, a storyteller like Ernest Scott might have laid claim to that authority. It also, if you'll allow me to diverge a little bit, Charlene, it brings me to a really interesting part of the narrative that I thoroughly enjoyed, but I grappled with. I was just like, I wonder, this is a great part of the story, but why is it there? And this is where in London, where Scarlett works, she falls in love. I'm not sure if you had a different cultural touchstone here, but I read Dylan. He was kind of a Taylor Swift, maybe Harry Styles. He is this sort of global sensation. There are scenes where Scarlett sees him writ large, sort of 60 foot tall on billboards. And in his art, Scarlett finds, I guess, a foil to her work as a truth teller. She says, it was a relief to shrug off any responsibility for the words in the space they would make their way into. I would never have any control over their interpretation, which is the opposite of what she does every day for her job. Dylan's role in the novel, it puzzled me a little, but I was, maybe you'd like to unpack that more, but I was also hoping to use him to ask you about art and how art juxtaposes history as a record of a time.
Well, there's an awful lot in there that I could speak to.
I've been accused of this before.
We could probably talk for an hour on this alone, but look, the device of Dylan is meant to show the idea of Scarlett as a metaphor for Australia and Dylan as a metaphor for the colonizer. And there he is, all powerful and huge, speaking his words out into the world with very little weight behind them. And Scarlett is envious of that, because isn't it true that all of us, when faced with hard things, we want to look away? You know, we want to shrug off weight of responsibility at times. It can feel too much and too heavy. And so here is Scarlett with this larger than life British colonizer, full control of the script and the narrative and his image. And she really does want that. And at the same time, she also thoroughly rejects it. And I think as humans, we are complex. We want things that are opposing. We want binaries. We want these things. And yet there's also something in it for me about Scarlett and Dylan where I want us to look at, are we judging rightly or wrongly? Like, is it fair of Scarlett to put that history on one human being? I'd like to also note that Scarlett never quotes Dylan. She only ever presents Dylan to us through her point of view. Through the best of her recollection. We see him as she shows us. So again, is she a credible narrator when it comes to Dylan? I don't know. That's up for the reader to decide. I also wanted to reveal Scarlett's relationship with power, and a love interest is always a way to reveal a person's relationship with power. And here's Dylan with all the power. And what power does Scarlett have? Now, I would argue Scarlett has lots and lots of power, lots of agency. But I think the way she tells us about Dylan, the way she behaves and responds to him, also gives us clues about her relationship with power and how these things are not easy. When you talk about art and how that works in the world, Scarlett's work is still creative, it's still artwork, and it's still her way of making sense of her way of being in the world and of the world she knows and how she understands it. And that's what all art is. And I think good art tells lots and lots of truth about where the world is. But I love listening to you talk about Dylan and your response to Dylan, because I absolutely leave you with more questions than answers, and I'm interested in people's responses to him.
Dylan is fascinating for his larger than life, I guess, persona and the fame that he enjoys. You establish that he's not just, he's clearly talented, or he is perceived to be talented. He's clearly successful. And it does. It opens up these questions where, I guess, in an ideal world, we want art, we hope art, we look to art to be a foil to authority. we look to art to perhaps show us parts of ourselves that we maybe even struggle to articulate. But it's also hard to separate the history of art from the from the history of patronage. And art that survives is often art that was able to be afforded and able to be preserved. So Dylan does present that really interesting, I think, contradiction. And of course, like the joy of it is in also the way it allows you to draw out Scarlett's character. Spoilers, like it's just there are so many different ways that we discover Scarlett, and this is such an interesting. But let's go a little bit to that. We're going to jump around a little bit again because I want to ask you a little bit. I'm very interested in your writing. I understand a little bit of the history of this novel and that it's emerged over years for you. In the novel, though, you weave through a now and a then, a before now. These narratives are interspersed to build up a picture of Scarlett's life and Scarlett's world. Was this a linear process for you? How did you craft and edit these timelines?
I really began with a strategy to trick myself that I wasn't really writing a novel because I don't know how to do that. So I wrote little vignettes and scenes and chapters and as they came to me. And then as time progressed and I had more and more of a word count, I began to order them. I really wanted to convey, though, this idea that whilst we do experience time as the linear arrow, that isn't really how we live our life and how we form our worldview. Our now is fiercely affected by what we believe our before to be, our past, our history. Our future is completely affected by our now. If we change our past and our history or the way we see it, that affects our now, and can that affect our future? And I guess this is kind of confusing, and this is the type of disorientation I was in while I was crafting it, because I wanted to have a sense of disorientation for the reader, because imagine Scarlett's disorientation. In uncovering truths she did not know about herself and her family, B, in then suddenly living in an entirely disconnected world, like for us, if all internet connection went down, what on earth would we do? So there's this way that I was writing in the same way that I was living and changing my own now and my own worldview due to the stories I was uncovering about my own history. And I think, therefore, putting it all together without giving a spoiler, there's a moment at the end where Scarlett is ordering her story. And it is a comment on this way that when we have agency and power over how we understand our story, we can change our future. And I don't think that anybody in Australia is going to see change in the areas that we want to see change without imagining a way through that. We need, back to your questions on art, you know, art gives us this incredible vehicle to imagine a different way. And when I was talking, actually, even with scientists, when I was trying to get my language right around blood talk and that biotechnology, they would say to me over and over, Charlene, science is also creative. It isn't as black and white and as mathematical and as linear as people seem to think it is. It's also very creative, thinking outside the box, imagining ways forward, and then seeing if empirical evidence can get us there. So I think as human beings, that is how we live our life. We don't live in this neat, tidy, linear structure. And I really wanted to convey that. It was challenging as I began to get more word count to order it in a way that made it work. And I used lots of strategies, like a big chalkboard wall that I painted, and I wrote notes and different things like that. I had lots of early readers helping me get the chronology right. Before the end, I went back and put the whole novel in chronological linear order to make sure it worked. But it was just really a grand adventure in how we experience time. for me.
I want to recall back to a question you asked before, and note how cleverly you answered it in your own novel. If everything did shut down, I think I would chorus on behalf of all the listeners here. We'd sit down and read a book, wouldn't we?
Let's hope so.
But you beautifully deal with that in the novel, in a section that I'm not talking about. But you deal with why Scarlett doesn't just sit down and read a book. I'm sorry, I'm trying not to cough here.
You're right.
Completely losing my thread there. Completely losing my thread.
No, you're right.
So given I guess this feast of ideas, we haven't really touched on genre except I think to say that I've suggested that you are working within ideas and within genres, which makes it a very interesting work to characterize. I feel it's speculative, almost science fiction in its conception. I think there's elements of satire here. There is elements of history, perhaps philosophy. In having Scarlett write over the faded short history of Australia, you situate it in this tradition of kind of being a source material that requires evaluation. Did you have a sense of how you hoped the reader might approach the novel?
Not until the end. I have a fiercely rebellious spirit when it comes to genre, borders, classifications and labels. I have ever since I can remember. And so even though I was studying literature and creative writing at uni at the time, I just kept refusing this idea of the commercial requirements for genre classifications. And so I think my natural storytelling, when it's just set free, it encompasses all those things you've just described. And so I just let it breathe and I let it be. And I was lucky enough to be a part of the Wheeler Center's next chapter. And in fact, one of the biggest things I encourage in that program is to try not to think about commercial factors and just let yourself be creative, because, you know, that's where great art erupts from. And so I didn't consider the reader and in the sense of genre, except that I knew I had to confuse fiction and nonfiction, because I think that that's what causes us to pause and think inside the novel. And again, I'm trying so hard not to give spoilers myself, but there are just these moments where you're like, oh, that can't be real. That couldn't really have happened in Australia. Oh, yes. It did. It happened to my family. And then there are other times where it's fiction, but it's super believable and you just swallow it like that. So I really do want to tease out those ideas and have the reader wonder, what Australia do I know? What line have I swallowed? How can I look at this differently, particularly, of course, when we're talking about First Nations stories and histories. So definitely now that's what I would say I would hope the reader responds. Does that make sense?
It does. It does. And I want to use that to take us, or take you perhaps onto safer ground where we don't have to skirt around the spoilers for, a moment or two. Because you sort of posed the question, well, what version of Australia have I swallowed? And I guess it depends on what you've understood, what you've read. And I really want to acknowledge The Great Undoing is this incredibly literate feast of writing in Australia. Scarlett Wheat reads widely. She quotes widely from Tara June Winch to David Malouf. Scarlett venerates these storytellers. So tell me about your love of Australian literature, because it is tremendous in this book. I loved it so much. I discovered some new things that it was just a joy to see.
Yeah, look, I have a long history of being a reader. I could read before I was four. And the one thing my mum never said no to was the Scholastic Book Club in primary school. I could always order a book. But here's the thing that was sad for me. When I got into my late 30s and early 40s, I realized that I'd been educated on books that weren't Australian. Mm. And in fact, the few Australian books I had been educated on were very, were leaning, you know, very much to a certain way of seeing Australia. And so when I then stumbled upon First Nation writers like Janine Lane, like Tara, like David Maloof, like Nam Lee, like Tony Birch, I had not long returned from living overseas. And I think there's something about being away from home that magnifies what home is, and particularly things you took for granted. And so when I was reading these books and feeling emplaced and not emplaced, feeling included and not included, it really caused me to ask questions about belonging, about what is home and who is in and who is out and who does have the power to say. And so that really, I now probably read 80% Australian authors every year. We have an embarrassment of riches, and particularly in First Nations writers, but Australian writers in general. And so I wanted to have Scarlett overtly acknowledge that she is a product of what she's read, because that was how I navigated my world. I had books. That was my way of experiencing the world. We were quite a poor family. We didn't travel. We didn't really go anywhere when I was young. And then in those my 30s, when I did travel and opened up my eyes to these things, it actually caused me to expand my worldview, but then refocus it back home. And I just wanted to show that Scarlett, in some ways, was delivering many voices by acknowledging that she is made up of all those stories that she's read and been told. That's how she's navigating her world in this story.
Mm. It's a really great point that you made there also about that wealth of storytelling that is available to us. I was fortunate to be speaking with Jane Harrison a couple of weeks ago, who is the director of the Black and Bright Literary Festival, and we talked a little bit about just exactly what seems to be this moment for First Nations, for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander storytellers. And I think what that acknowledges is not just that those stories are out there, because of course they are out there, of course they have always been there, but that there is an appetite for them, there is a hunger for them, and that it's horrible to bring it down to commercial interests, but I think you've tacitly acknowledged that yourself, Charlene. Like, there are commercial interests there in any industry, and even they can't be ignored now. These stories must be published because people are demanding them.
Yeah, and look, I hope that people are reading them and not just buying them. That's my hope. And it's something I was really conscious of when I was writing, that I wanted this to be a rollicking adventure that would draw a reader in, and then I might, you know, slot in a sneak attack with a little bit of, you know, truths that are important. And so you're absolutely right. I think it's just the commercial part of the sector that's catching up. They have always been there. I think back to Ruby Langford Ginnaby back in the 80s. You know, that's 50 years ago now. But I'm thrilled that commercially this is catching up. I just hope that we're not only being bought, not only being talked about, but that those stories are being read, because they are incredible. And just this year alone, we have amazing works to be read. I can't keep up with my to-be-read list.
Try making a show where you can't. I have to keep up.
I don't know how you do it.
So we have Scarlett. She is working as a truth teller in London. She's being romanced by a superstar. And then, of course, the titular Great Undoing occurs. Blood Talk shuts down. The world is adrift. Scarlett finds herself on the run, facing the possibility of being illegal, an on-water matter, a boat person. I think we might leave the listener to discover where all this is going in the book. But is there anything you'd like to say about Scarlett's predicament, or perhaps how it emerges, how it reflects on our contemporary world?
There is an element, and I think it really came to the fore a little bit during the pandemic, that the civilized world really does operate on a very thin veneer of civility. And that if you take down a few things, we're not all in the same boat, but we're all in the same storm. And so by introducing this cataclysmic event, even Dylan, this incredibly wealthy, influential superstar, where is his power now? There is no access to money. There is no access to billboards in Times Square or Piccadilly Circus. There's no influencing. There's no platforms. You know, what is he left with? What kind of power does he really have? And then when we look at Scarlett and we think, well, you know, what power did she lose? Does she actually still have the same power she always had? These are questions. I'm certainly not trying to answer them, but there's something attractive about a global cataclysmic event from the point of view of a novel writer, not a human being, that just throws up all those questions about power and influence and an ability to change the world for good or for bad if certain things disappear. And so I just found that super interesting as a writer to explore and to ask questions of. And unfortunately, I did not enjoy some of the answers provided during the real pandemic.
Yeah. Because, of course, it's never a matter of will we continue. It's inherent in that quote that I gave before, like, what if no one tells our stories? What if there are no records? Well, to tell the story, to imagine the story, means someone is telling the story. And it is very much then about how and what do we do. That's all there for the reader to discover in The Great Undoing. And I hope what we've shown them in the conversation, Charlene, is that it is a tremendous ride to get there, that there are some incredible things to discover. So I really appreciate the time that you've taken today. I told you before we started the conversation I was not going to spoil anything beyond certain points in the novel. Is there anything else you'd like to add, though, before we say goodbye?
I think the final thing on that point where you were just talking about the questions of what makes us real? How do we go on? How do stories live on? There's a real key there for me about relationships. And I'd love the reader to be on the lookout for that in the novel, that when we're in relationships and we have people to share our stories with and people whose stories we have to listen to, I think there's something really key and really foundational in that discovery of Scarlett as to why stories matter and how stories work when we're disconnected from the world. Yeah, there's something interesting in that to me.
Well, thank you so very, very much. I'm just going to let everybody know, I am speaking with Charlene Allsop. We are discussing her debut novel. It is called The Great Undoing. It is a tremendous work for all the things we've discussed and especially for the things that we have chosen to leave up to you, dear reader, to discover. Charlene, thank you so much for your time today.
It was so lovely to be here. Thanks for having me, Andrew.
Thank you for joining me today on the Final Draft podcast, where we featured Charlene Allsop's The Great Undoing. Thank you again to Charlene. It was a tremendous chat. I hope you enjoyed it. Final Draft is recorded on the lands of the Darug and the Gunungurra people. The show is produced and presented by Andrew Popel. Stay in touch. You can find Final Draft across Australia on the Community Radio Network. You can listen on podcasts, which is what you're doing right now. And you can reach out to us on social media, Final Draft at Final Draft 2SER. You know what, though? If you're just interested in discovering new books, subscribe to the podcast in your podcast app. Wherever you're looking now, click follow. Click whatever button lets you get new episodes every single week. My name's Andrew Papel. I will be back next week with more incredible conversations from Australian authors. Till then, happy reading. Bye for now.